The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup. Chelsea and Liverpool spend afternoon drawing with pens, then Liverpool write their name on the cup. Meanwhile in the league, there's a twist as Man City draw with West Ham. Pep's players unrecognisable, like City had just commissioned a statue of them. Now, prepare the guest room for Mr. and Mrs. Narrative as City head to a final day showdown with Stevie G. We'll be drawing our conclusions on that, the relegation battle and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Would you look at that, listener? It's Monday the 16th of May. And we've got Daniel Story, Dom Fifield and Sasha Gurionov lined up. All right, everyone.
Morning.
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 First of all, congratulations on the hard-fought cup win. Daniel Story.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was a tense affair. Went long as well, didn't it?
Yeah, sudden death.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, how are you feeling?
Yes, good, thank you very much. Glad to have that outside of the back of my mind at all times.
Right, right. What's replaced it in your kind of worry zone?
Forest.
Oh, there's always a queue. I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Forest, right, yeah. All right, meanwhile, on cloud nine right now, it is Sasha Gurionov. Yeah.
Yeah, it's endless, scoreless cup wins for Liverpool at the moment.
Well, I have to say, as a neutral, I'm really enjoying these hours and hours of goalless football.
The Italians must be loving it.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, there's plenty to talk about today. Not least the drama at the London Stadium on Sunday and what that means for Liverpool's other ambitions this season, and people's semi-final playoffs and that kind of thing. But of course, we should begin with the FA Cup final Saturday afternoon.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
The FA Cup final sometimes does spring up unlikely heroes. Here's Tsimikas. Liverpool's hero!
Konstantinos Tsimikas winning the FA Cup final for Liverpool. Sasha, 2 out of 4 then. 2 finals, 1 without actually scoring a goal. But huge celebrations nonetheless.
Yeah, great release once Tsimikas puts away his penalty. These Liverpool-Chelsea games, yeah, do seem to have gone on for a long, long time. In fact, if you consider all the injury time and all the extra time played, those four games that they've played out this season are probably worth 5. And they're all draws. Having said that, I thought that this particular final, Chelsea were a lot less impressive than they were in February. I think they really missed Havertz and his sort of clever movement. Liverpool, on their part, again lost a key player, but didn't really seem to suffer too much from it. And having said that, after a very quick start, I thought Chelsea did their best to do a bit of a Villarreal, trying to kill the pace, you know, taking the time over injuries, trying to sort of put Liverpool off the stride while sort of waiting to pounce on the odd mistake here and there. So I think also you have to consider when, you know, timing of this match, and it was very hot, so in the extra time, the whole thing died. But I have to say, I think the entire Liverpool end thought very dark thoughts when Mane's penalty was saved. But fortunately, there was redemption.
All right. Only 4 shots on target between the two sides, but probably worth it as a match for the Trent pass alone. What did you make of it, Daniel?
Yeah, I thought it's interesting in that all of these games I've felt, Chelsea-Liverpool, you can tell Liverpool are a significantly better side than one place in the league table suggests, I think. We know there's a 2 at the top of the Premier League and then a little group of teams, Chelsea, Tottenham, Arsenal. And exactly as Sasha says, it felt like Chelsea were trying to subdue Liverpool. It felt like they were much more worried about the threat against them than they were about pushing Liverpool and challenging them, which was a bit different to the League Cup final. Lukaku struggled. It was a big call by Tuchel to play him. And he didn't really affect the game. When he plays well, he takes 2 defenders and therefore creates space for others. When he doesn't play well, he kind of does the opposite, which meant that Liverpool, it always felt like Liverpool were playing in a kind of comfort mode. But Chelsea defended well. And with these sort of things, we have to react to the end result. But let's face it, we were two kicks away from saying Chelsea win through adversity. Tuchel gets it done in another cup final, despite all the noise going on with this talk of Andreas Christensen declaring himself unavailable for the game. Rudiger's leaving. There's a lot of uncertainty around Chelsea, and yet Tuchel came pretty close against a team that is better than them of achieving something really significant. But you know, that's penalties. It comes down to those very fine margins. Aspilicueta clipping a post and Tsimikas putting his penalty inside it, and sometimes those are the differences. But bigger than that, we have to look at Liverpool as this kind of trophy-winning machine under Klopp. They've done the lot. Trent Alexander-Arnold's done the lot at such a young age. And as ever with Liverpool, it never feels like the final they've just won is enough. It always feels like they're looking forward for, right, that's done, that's parked, what's next?
It's an interesting one with Chelsea, and Daniel's right. It has been quite an unsettling few months for them. But I don't think you can necessarily use that as an excuse for this. I mean, the reality is that Liverpool won the FA Cup without Mo Salah on the pitch, without Virgil van Dijk on the pitch at the end, and without Fabinho on the pitch. Okay, Kai Havertz and Timo Werner were both ruled out with hamstring problems, which did actually hamstring Chelsea and Tuchel, because I think he would have looked very seriously at that Havertz more fluid movement up top to unsettle Liverpool, because it's worked against them in the past this season. But it's just been three very, very difficult months for Chelsea off the pitch, and I think it has had an effect. I mean, Tuchel said as much. It has unsettled them as a group, and it's in that context, I suppose it's an achievement to have got to an FA Cup final. But I'm more interested in how people actually rate the season now, because they come away with two pieces of silverware, albeit legacies from last season, the UEFA Super Cup and the FIFA Club World Cup, all, you know, born of their Champions League success last summer. They've reached a League Cup final, an FA Cup final, and they probably will finish third. I mean, at most clubs, that's a pretty good season. But I think at Chelsea, there's a sense of anticlimax about it all. Not least when they were winning the FIFA Club World Cup. I think everybody thought they would kick on. They would, you know, potentially there'll be more silverware to celebrate this year. So it's almost like this season is going to be a bit of a hangover going into the summer and the takeover. And they've now got to rejuvenate that entire squad. But I was also going to ask Sasha, what happens, Sasha, if Liverpool don't win the Premier League and get beaten by Real Madrid? Do people look at this season as a success with two trophies and domestic cups?
And I think that certainly will be disappointment at not adding to the two existing trophies. But at the same time, I think if you look at the bigger picture, again, if this feels like Liverpool on the upper trajectory again. So no matter how ridiculous it might sound, second place in the Premier League, Champions League final, two cups, feeling is they could probably do better next season. And you have someone like, say, Konate, who is going to be coming more into his own next season. Let's see how Thiago looks like. But also, I mean, if you look at Liverpool now, compared to a few years ago, you can see there's a depth in squad. I mean, you mentioned those injuries, they're missing those players. But, you know, when Salah walked off on Saturday, there was certainly apprehension and concern, but there wasn't like this panic that, for example, we had 3 years ago when he was off injured against, I think, Newcastle, and certainly not like in final 2018. So there is a depth, there is a confidence to the side, and there is a feeling that this can be built upon. And also, I think it would be nice to have a parade at the end of this whole thing, because there's the overdue celebration for Liverpool's state title in 2020. Then that celebration never happened. But certainly, I think as a fan base, the feeling is it's onwards and upwards. And the feeling is everybody in the squad can, you know, step up. Like, for example, you know, the final in February is the Kelleher final. This is going to be the Tsimikas final. You know, sort of squad players who contribute at, you know, vital moments. And I think also for this particular game, if we actually go back to the original question, I think James asked about the pass from Trent to Diaz, which he should have put away. This is, again, you know, yet another vindication of Liverpool's transfer policy. Diaz was man of the match in this game. You know, he came in January. I think, you know, without Diaz, and I think it's been widely recognized, Liverpool probably don't push on to the level of success they are enjoying at the moment, because I think their squad, again, as these injuries are showing, their squad is being stretched, but yet they're managing it. So yes, I think if they only end up with two trophies, there will be disappointment. But at the same time, you know, it's not going to be like, oh, let's rip up the whole template again. Because you see, you have also Klopp staying on, and everything feels like the project is moving forward.
All right, you'll be able to take positives even if, you know, the next... Okay, good. Chelsea, meanwhile, have to deal with losing in the FA Cup final for the third year in a row. As Daniel says, they were only a couple of penalty kicks away from having a very different a narrative on this Monday morning. But then again, how much of a lottery are penalty kicks against Liverpool? Because you always seem to win them, Sasha.
We do. And this is before before Klopp got Neuro 11 on board. So I've seen Liverpool now.
What's Neuro 11?
A bunch of neuroscientists who helped Klopp apparently with penalties and helped Liverpool prepare for penalties. But then historically, ever since Rome...
Can I just say it's great these days that even kind of groups of scientists come with their own kind of names, like the Neuro 11.
Yeah. Hashtag or maybe at Neuro 11.
But
I mean, Klopp certainly praised them after the match. And with Liverpool historically, I mean, since that final in Rome in 84, Liverpool have only lost one cup final on penalties. I mean, I've personally seen them.
Out of how many?
Out of...
I know that it's 19 they've won out of 26.
Yeah, that's overall. But when it comes to the crunch, I think it's 7 out of 8. And I've been to six of those wins. And so, yeah, I've seen Liverpool win 8 cups and 6 of those have been on penalties. So when it comes to penalties, you're quite confident that they will somehow do it despite ups and downs during the shootout itself. I think Chelsea were playing for penalties on Saturday for large parts of that game. And... you know, Liverpool have the better goalkeeper and Liverpool have history and neuroscientists on their side. So maybe it wasn't the right idea.
I think the only obvious thing to jump out of the penalty shootout, slightly ironically, because it was a Liverpool missed penalty rather than the Chelsea ones, are Mane's penalty against Mendy. The idea of putting up a player against his international colleague is a kind of slightly awkward one, I think. This was the first time in English football history that two teams have met in penalties in the same season, but Mane and Mendy have actually done it at international level. They played two penalty shootouts against Egypt this season. So Edouard Mendy has seen a lot of Sadio Mane taking penalties one way or another. Klopp spoke after the game about, you know, did he tell Mane to go a different way? Did that get into his head? If at any point you change your decision, I think that becomes an issue. But I thought that was an interesting point. And also, I was surprised that Azpilicueta took a penalty so early for Chelsea. Dom will know far more about this than me, but I can't remember the last time I saw defenders taking the first three penalties for a club in a shootout. If I was asked to name Chelsea's five best penalty takers on the pitch towards the end of extra time, I would have naturally had Loftus-Cheek above Azpilicueta, probably. And obviously Loftus-Cheek was taken off purely because he wasn't seen as a penalty taker and Ross Barkley scored his. But yeah, I was a bit surprised that Azpilicueta went quite so early. But
I suspect that was just him being a leader and trying to show that he can, I mean, potentially probably his last major showpiece event with Chelsea. I mean, there's a good chance that he leaves the club in the summer. He's got two home games left to go, but this was going to be his big send-off, and it didn't really go to plan.
One curious moment with penalties as well, I thought. After every Chelsea penalty, Alisson grabbed the ball and, you know, gave it to his colleague to take the next one. And on his save, if he doesn't do that, the ball rolls back in. You know those clips you see on YouTube, penalty goes safe, keeper goes wild, and the ball bounces back into the net. The ball was going to do the same if Alisson wasn't there, but he could have quietly picked it up and, you know, gave it to the next, to Tsimikas. But yeah, it was curious because we were down the other end and we were like, oh, it's gone up in the air. And clearly, too much YouTube, we're thinking it's going to roll back in. But Alisson was there.
Sash, you mentioned the injuries before. Mo Salah, Van Dijk, Robertson as well. Luis Diaz, who looked like he banged his head nastily when the FA Cup lid dropped on him. How much of a concern is that, you know, with the games coming up, hashtag?
Yeah, so it sounds like Salah and Van Dijk, sounds like they were precautionary. Fabinho, again, sounds like he's going to be back for the Champions League final. Of course, we're going to move on to the Man City game next. But I think, you know, if it was still down to goal difference, I would really struggle to see Liverpool trying to score a million goals against Southampton on Tuesday, because this was an exhausting game. Plus all the injuries. So I think it's kind of, you know, back to Liverpool just grinding out wins in the league as I have been doing so far, rotating superbly without necessarily any pressure to go hell for leather, because I think after Saturday they genuinely need a bit of a rest, and the fact they have a game 72 hours later is quite challenging.
It is indeed. All right, we'll talk about that and what happened with Man City very shortly. Quick shout out though for the other FA Cup final this weekend on Sunday. Chelsea going up against Man City, and Sam Kerr once again, star of the show, with Chelsea's opening and decisive final goal in a 3-2 victory over Man City in front of almost 50,000 fans. Her record is now 8 goals in her last 4 consecutive domestic cup finals. Extraordinary.
Yeah, it was a very similar game and a very different game in that it was obviously packed full of goals. It was 3-2 after extra time. But it felt exactly the same in that you always felt Chelsea had the advantage, and yet Manchester City, by scoring equalisers, kept themselves in the game. Sam Kerr is a cheat code in English women's football at the moment, because she's electric. Her movement is incredible. Her finishing is incredible. Her second goal, the winning goal, is slightly lucky. I'm not actually sure it was going in. She's credited with it, but I think it might have been going wide before the deflection. And the first goal was a poacher's goal. It was an overhit cross that I think there were two Manchester City defenders there. I think if there'd been one defender there, I think they would have kind of dived to try and clear it. But I think the fact there were two meant they sort of left it for each other, and Kerr just kind of nicked in after it had gone over the goalkeeper's head. But yeah, Erin Cuthbert's goal was the goal of the game. A fantastic strike off the underside of the bar from 20 yards. And yet Chelsea always... I never assumed they weren't going to win it, and yet... You know, it went to extra time and therefore it was close. But yeah, poor Alana Kennedy, who makes the mistake for the winning goal, trying to kind of cut out the long ball forward, and the bounce slightly does her, and yeah, Kerr just punishes it.
Chelsea retain the trophy, which they'd only just won, of course, back in December. You can hear more about that on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast, which will be out on Tuesday. All right, next up for us, Premier League.
Well, Eintracht Frankfurt may lie 11th in the Bundesliga, but we all know they have punched well above their weight in the Europa League this season. David Moyes had his eye on the prize when he rested the apple of his eye, Declan Rice, against Chelsea in a league match a few weeks back, with a view to having the midfield domino fresh to see off the Germans. But it didn't work out like that, as Frankfurt managed to burst the Hammers' bubble, both home and away, to book a place in the final, where they will now meet Glasgow Rangers in Sevilla. The form had been in the book, though, as the German outfit had also scalped Barca in the round beforehand, with a 3-2 win at the Nou Camp, dumping out Xavi's men. Frankfurt are also only the third finalist in Europa League history to start the season in the group stage and not lose a single match en route to the final. Rangers, meanwhile, saw off a fancied Leipzig side in their semi-final, and Giovanni van Bronckhorst's men will now be aiming to become the first Scottish side to win a European trophy since Sir Alex's Aberdeen won the Cup Winners' Cup back in 1983. Amazingly, the blue half of Glasgow have won 18 European knockout ties in the last four seasons. Very impressive. So this game is sure to be an interesting one. The Paddy Power Traders make Frankfurt the favourites at 13-10. The draw is 23-10 and the Rangers win is 2-1. Frankfurt deserve their favourites tag and will be looking to become the first German side to lift the Europa League since Schalke did back 25 years ago, when it was known back then, kids, as the UEFA Cup. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Yes. The comeback. And Fabianski, he's got a great record of saving penalties, saves that one. Dawson says thanks very much. And Mahrez has to take it on the chin.
Final day of the season in the Premier League looks set to be a tasty one, with one relegation spot still to be decided, three teams in the running for that. Arsenal and Spurs duking it out for the fourth Champions League place, and the title race very much still on, as long as Liverpool don't lose to Saints on Tuesday. Man City had a chance on Sunday to pretty much put it to bed in a remarkable match at West Ham. Before we get into what Man City did and didn't do, what did David Moyes and West Ham do here against a team that had just set, remember, coming into this match, a English record, the first team in top flight history to win five consecutive league games by a margin of three goals? So how did the Hammers stop them?
Moyes kept Jared Bowen as high up the pitch as he could. We're used to Mikel Antonio kind of leading that line. He actually dropped a bit deeper and was almost kind of linking play slash trying to drag defenders out, drag Fernandinho out, and had Bowen as the highest man forward to basically try and break that City line. And that's exactly what they did. City were incredibly complicit in both goals. They lost so many second balls in that first half, in their own half. And Bowen was brilliant because he made two perfect runs, both of which in real time I assume are going to be, you know, one of those horrendous late offside flags where we wait until we all get excited and then realise we shouldn't be. And neither were, and neither were particularly close. They were brilliant breaking runs from Bowen. Incredible composure. I mean, this is a guy who I see why he wasn't in the last England squad, because Southgate had a settled squad and Bowen at that point felt quite new in terms of absolute peak form. But he has remained in that peak form almost longer than anyone else in the Premier League this season, I think. Certainly longer than anyone else outside the Big Six. He will be in the next England squad, I'm sure of that. And he deserves to be, because the composure to... It's not that easy to round Edison. He's a brilliant goalkeeper at one-on-ones. And he made it look incredibly easy. The finish is much better than he got credit for from a tight angle. And the second one is brilliant, because he's already done Edison on the first goal. So Edison's worried about him going round him. So he takes the shot really early before Edison's even had a chance to set himself. So West Ham were phenomenal in that first half, but City were, and we'll talk about them, but they were, you know, yes, they came back, but they were complicit in that. They were dreadful. I think Guardiola made a huge mistake in picking Laporte and Fernandinho. If I'm Nathan Ake, yes, I'm getting paid quite a lot of money. Yes, I'm going to play for a potential Premier League champion, but if I've cost 40 million, I want to be playing in those games when Diaz and Stones aren't available and Kyle Walker's not available.
I'd argue one thing that Bowen did very smartly there, and I think teams are doing this, they're targeting Zinchenko at left back and the way he kind of looks across that line. So I think the junction between Zinchenko and Laporte wasn't quite working. And if you look at the two Bowen runs, Zinchenko stops in those situations at just the wrong moment to let Bowen through. And I think this is, I really like Bowen because I think he's been in fantastic form, not just for West Ham, but like for the last 5 years. Because remember, he got his chance at Hull amid the ashes of yet another summer where there was no one else to play. And he really took it. And I mean, I went to Villa Park to actually see his first goal for them. And I think he's literally the best of English. He's a very direct, eye for goal, smart movement. And he reads the situation really, really well. And this directness, I think, sometimes really catches out the opponents. And I think this is where sort of Zinchenko and Laporte, they were slightly off, and he nips straight in there. Of course, higher position than he usually plays, but he can play across those three, or he can even play up top for West Ham. He had a chance, very sharp one, in the second half as well. And I think, again, he might be overpriced because he's English and whatever else. Don't know if he's a top four player, but certain... And I mean, where does he move for West Ham, actually? Because West Ham are going to probably finish sixth, they're going to finish at least seventh this season. So maybe he's in the right spot, but certainly seems to be like really sort of selflessly... And yet slightly selfishly blossoming in this environment that Moyes created for him. I think he's the top scorer in 15 years in terms of Premier League goals, something like 12 Premier League goals. So very, very good environment for him. And I thought in that first half, you know, he pretty much had the two chances and he took them. And, you know, at halftime, I think the rest of everyone watching the game had to sit down and think, whoa, is it actually happening?
Well, indeed, because Man City have this dreadful record when going a goal down or two, as it was in this case, since 1995... 107 times they've gone behind, or they've been behind at half time. How many of those 107 matches have they come back to win? Two. That defensive setup, though, fruit partially of the absence of Kyle Walker. How much are you anticipating that being the case against Villa next weekend?
They've got a problem because that kind of high line with not particularly quick central defenders and Zinchenko being slightly sloppy, as Sasha says. They get away with that when Walker's in the team because of the recovery pace. And I think, you know, I don't know if Walker would have got back to stop Bowen both times, but he would have certainly given Bowen more to think about by sprinting round and trying to intercept. And Walker is not going to be fit next weekend, I don't think. I'd be very surprised if he plays Fernandinho and Laporte again as a partnership, because Laporte's been reportedly kind of struggling with fitness issues and injury and kind of limping through the last few weeks of the season. And Fernandinho's in the kind of mode where he's permanently like that now, because the legs just aren't, you know, he's never been rapid, but the legs just aren't there anymore to chase back and defend. He's a defensive midfielder. He's basically a tactical fowler by design now, which he still managed to do from centre-back. Let's not worry about that. But yeah, I think it has to be Ake and Laporte, I suggest, against Villa next weekend.
A week without a game, though, I mean, it gives them a bit of chance to patch these guys up and get them ready for one last fixture. I'd imagine they'd be a bit more watertight, but they may also just be confident that they can monopolise the ball against Villa and inflict all manner of damage at the other end of the pitch, which would eclipse their defensive issues.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I would also say that if there's one team, when they're playing well, and they haven't been recently, yeah. if there's one team set up to kind of exploit that as West Ham did, it's probably Villa, because they play Watkins and Ings, who are two strikers who don't actually get into the box very much. They roam around, and whichever of Coutinho or Buendia he plays, and I hope he plays Buendia, the movement from them as well, that really can hurt City on the break.
Well, see, this is the thing. I went to see, last Tuesday, I went to see Villa-Liverpool, and I came away from that thing because Liverpool were very much in power save mode. And I was thinking, City are going to shred these because the defence isn't great. But looking at City yesterday and exactly how West Ham played, Villa showed that against Liverpool. And also Bertrand Traore coming on for the last 10 minutes was very direct and very, very dangerous. So I think they'll probably give that City defence a running. So if Villa can stay in the game, maybe there is a hope for a result there. But I don't know. I was on Tuesday, I thought it's a foregone conclusion. After Sunday, I think maybe Villa do have a bit of a chance of taking something off City.
Wow. Well, a little bit like Chelsea City. We're, of course, only a missed penalty kick away from having a very different conversation this Monday morning. Riyad Mahrez with that late penalty saved by Lucas Fabianski. I wonder if, will it be Erling Haaland taking spot kicks for them next season?
I don't think I can't remember a player standing over a penalty who, and it's very easy to say in hindsight, who I was more sure wasn't going to score than Riyad Mahrez with that penalty. It does him a disservice because he has scored penalties, and the one we remember is the one at Anfield that he plays over the bar. But I just, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of sort of old man thing to say, a kind of proper football man thing to say maybe, but A, I hate that run-up, and B, if I've got Kevin De Bruyne on the pitch, I'm very happy with him shooting from 12 yards. Even if he just passes it into a bottom corner, that's fine by me. And if a keeper saves that, fine. But Morris tends to do that. He tends to whip his penalties across the goalkeeper. And when you do that, you inevitably get some height, which is fine when he hits it top corner, which he sometimes does. But at that height, that's basically the perfect penalty for a goalkeeper to save if he goes the right way.
Hmm. Although a lot of people point you to Harry Kane's lower a technique as being the perfect spot kick. We'll touch on Spurs a bit later on. City having come back to level it with a fantastic goal from Jack Grealish, and then an own goal from Vladimir Sufal. West Ham, who are now guaranteed to at least be in the Conference League next season, will be away at Brighton on the final day. They are 2 points behind Man United. And who have Man United got? Fact fans.
Palace.
Ooh, Dom.
Ooh, go on, Palace.
At Selhurst Park.
Yep, where Palace haven't beaten Manchester United since 1991.
Well, if ever there was a time.
If someone better check that. Well, I'm pretty sure that's true.
Feels right. All right. Well, we'll preview, of course, all those fixtures come Thursday.
Just give City some credit there. That you know, West Ham have beaten Liverpool at home this season. They've beaten Chelsea at home this season, and they were 2-0 up against Manchester City this season. And that was quite the comeback second half for a team that is clearly leggy as well, struggling a bit in terms of the back line. And I actually thought for a period that this was going to be Jack Grealish's big moment. This was going to be the time where he actually, you know, wrote his name all over the title race. Or maybe he'll save that up for Aston Villa at home, which would, you know, have its own subplot. But I thought the way that they came back into it and almost claimed that victory was just a reminder that they are quite the team.
Yeah, it felt like Grealish had been told at half-time by Guardiola that he has to take his man on a bit more, which is why they signed him. If you were going to sign someone to shuttle the ball back, they wouldn't have... A, I don't think they'd have signed anyone because they've got plenty of players that can do that. But the way he draws fouls has to become a larger part of his role at City. It might not be it might be something that winds opposition fans up, but if he takes on his man, he will be fouled if he doesn't beat that man. And that's exactly what happened for the second goal and the first goal. Yes, it's a deflection, but he's finally in those areas. He's looking to get at that back post. Gary Neville in the last two City games has been kind of apoplectic that Grealish is not at the back post for a chance or taking on his man. And he's right. And Guardiola must be saying that to him. I don't know if it's a confidence thing because he did it all the time at Villa. And he has got players around him now who can do just as good, if not better, things than him with the ball. But he has to take that man on because it stretches the game for City and it wins them free kicks from which they'll score. They've scored more set-piece goals than anyone else this season.
Well, he did contribute a phenomenal goal in this one. And that point means, Sash, as you were pointing out, that Liverpool are not going to be chasing goal difference in their penultimate game of the season this time around away at Saints, which had made everybody, Nick Miller in particular, think back to another occasion when they'd been chasing the title and looking for a goal difference on the penultimate day of the season. Dom, I know you remember that one.
I remember that one largely because I was writing a colour piece on Liverpool that night for The Guardian and had to file at 80 minutes. So it was all about how Liverpool were back in it. It's all going great. And it was the only time in my life, I think, I've actually cursed a two-goal Palace comeback in the last 10 minutes.
Christanbul. Away at Saints, Sasha. That's Tuesday night. Any concerns that there'll be an unexpected twist there?
Well, to be honest, not really, because I think Liverpool have been... I think for many, sort of, the league campaign has gone. Something has given a bit of hope. I think Liverpool have also shown themselves to be competent enough against the non-Big Six sides this season again. I mean, they've played 26 games against them, 22 wins, 2 draws, 2 defeats. So I think they should be able to manage that game to win, as they have been showing over the last few weeks. You know, just basically just getting it over the line in the league and whilst they're keeping up the cup runs. You know, as we mentioned, you know, after the cup final, with all the injuries, they have to be able to manage their squad, but they've shown they can rotate about 5 or 6 players and still keep up with the levels. So not too much concern. I think with Liverpool fans at the moment, it's a midweek game on the south coast, so I think the tickets are actually quite easy to come by. But the last trip to Southampton that I remember was in 2019, which was actually quite significant for Liverpool in longer term, because that was when Jordan Henderson moved into number 8 position. That was a beautiful comeback. Very stirring scenes as Liverpool got 2 late goals. So, yeah, I'm going to be going down to St. Mary's with a bit of optimism, a bit of hope, and just hope to enjoy some football.
I have to say that Southampton have won 1 league game since February, so even a weary Liverpool should prevail there.
All right. Stand by to hear that with echoey sound effects. Replayed on Thursday.
I'd just like to apologise to all Liverpool supporters.
All right, next up, we'll have a think about the relegation picture.
See the ballet last night, Dave?
No, I missed it.
Cracking performance from the Rombert. The lad de Silva was right on his game, banging in the pas de deux he was.
We know fans go a little gaga once the football season is over, so make the most of whatever's left with Paddy Power's Bet Builder offer. Money back as a free bet if one leg of your 4+4 Bet Builder lets you down. Paddy Power!
Pre-match online bet but bets only. Min odds 1-5 per leg. Max free bet £10 per day. 7-day free bet expiry. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
All right, the situation down the bottom. Burnley, currently in the bottom three, 18th on 34 points. 1 point above them, Leeds, and Everton, 1 point above them. Both Everton and Burnley have a game in hand on Leeds, which I guess is why lots of people are saying Leeds are favourite to go down, even though it's Burnley in the bottom three. Those games in hand coming up this Thursday when Burnley will be at Villa, another team who's depending on Villa for their end of season. And Everton will be hosting Crystal Palace, Dom. What to make of all of this?
Massive Thursday night. I mean, it's huge. I mean, Everton's the chaotic nature of that game against Brentford and the sendings off and the... I mean, a bit Leeds-esque, really, because they're now losing players through injury and suspension at a critical time of the season. And albeit Palace will have absolutely nothing really to play for, that won't be an easy occasion on Thursday. And it's another one of those times that Frank Lampard's going to have to whip up the locals and get them, you know, crowding out the bus and letting off fireworks the night before in team hotels and all that business just to get Everton through it. I mean, it's going to be a hell of an occasion.
The fireworks outside Brentford's gaff were quite phenomenal, actually.
But then I think basically Brentford weaponized this after winning the game, saying, you know, the fireworks were on the pitch. And then I think was it Janssen was saying, oh, they only lasted 10 seconds or something like that. So I think they turned that one on its head.
Maybe I'm reading, I'm putting two and two and making seven or eight here, but I did wonder, given the chaotic nature of the game, given the sendings off, given the kind of rash decisions they made, I'm not sure that kind of hoopla before the game helps teams necessarily that much. What you want in those sort of scenarios, Everton should have been favourites for that game, just as they should be favourites on Thursday. What you want is to just... Everton have got better players than anyone else in the bottom six. What you want is to play with control and those players to show why they are the best players in the bottom six. And I don't think whipping up that storm... I can see why you whip up a storm if you're underdogs and you're trying to create this kind of hard atmosphere for the opposition teams, but for a home game against Brentford on a Sunday afternoon, I don't think it works that much. I think what you want is to just play with clear heads and not play on the edge. And Everton, I just think they're falling into this trap of every game's a cup final, every game's a cup final. And actually, it shouldn't be like that. They have it in their own hands. They should be in control. They should just be playing the game on its merit. It's very hindsight orientated, you know, but I just think it was a kind of misstep.
Daniel, you know what I would say? I agree, like in general terms of what you're saying. But I think for Everton, for the fans, for the team, I think this has actually been hugely important because I think they've been dead inside for such a long time. And the fact that they managed to rouse themselves for sort of this passionate end of season, you know, fans meeting the bus, the flares, the colour, the atmosphere. I think they needed that to shake themselves back into life. Whether they then can go rational against Brentford, maybe that's just not the way forward. Maybe, yes, I mean, they completely lost their heads and it looked like a complete calamity. But perhaps without whipping up that fever in the first place, they wouldn't be in the situation where they actually managed to drag themselves out of the bottom three. And maybe they just need to somehow, you know, it's almost as if like they've all turned into Jordan Pickford in the stands and on the pitch and it's all a bit nuts.
Yeah. Or Salomon Rondon.
Salomon Rondon, I felt very sad for him doing that. But yes, there is obviously that the danger that you will overstep the mark and just fall off a cliff. But I think maybe in this situation, maybe this is what they need. Because I think for so many years now, so much apathy, the club drifting somewhere, and they're literally standing on the precipice. And maybe this is the moment when everyone kind of, maybe it's all a bit chaotic, but just everyone just getting their shit together and getting themselves to do something with a bit of passion, with a bit of fire to them.
I mean, it's traditional for Everton to suffer with the Reds, I suppose. That's five players they've had sent off in the last 11 games. But Rondon, a particularly choice example. For anyone who wasn't following this, what exactly happened with his brief vignette?
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, you can follow... Yeah. We could almost talk through his appearance in real time. He came on with 6 minutes to go. Basically, a roll of the dice call from Lampard, which is fair enough. Richarlison was limping around a bit. Dermot Calvert-Lewin was limping around a bit. And he sent on Rondon to just chase a goal. And within, I think, 220 seconds, Rondon has lost the ball. And then it was almost like a slow motion two-footed tackle. It was like he sort of sat down at speed in the way he sort of thrust his two legs out and then immediately apologised. And was rightly shown a red card. And then sort of applauded the crowd and got a high five from Lampard, which is the most misplaced high five I can remember because he just completely let down his team. And I mean, at least Lampard won't
be... I'm not sure he was applauding. I thought he put his hands together as if he was sort of praying for forgiveness almost.
Okay.
His head and it's sort of like... They didn't clap. They were sort of there, please forgive me. Oh, you're not going to get forgiven for that, pal.
Yeah, let's see what happens next week first. We should say on Everton and Leeds, my big worry is that given Gerrard is Villa's manager and an ex-Liverpool player and will want to do something next weekend, I do worry for Leeds and Everton where Villa may not quite go at full pelt on Thursday night against Burnley. Because they play Thursday and Sunday, which I don't know. I think Burnley will win on Thursday night.
Burnley, who have only just played Villa, of course, and got beaten quite comfortably by Steven Gerrard's side. We should mention Brentford, who won this game, and as a result are enjoying all these shenanigans from the lofty heights of 11th. In fact, could finish the season in the top half of the table. Had the season began, as many wished, when Christian Eriksen signed or made his first start for them, they'd be fourth in the Premier League, for people who enjoy stats like that. Anyway, There you go. And they, of course, will be facing Leeds on the final day. Sasha.
I was just going to say, I thought one thing with the Everton game, I thought at this stage of the season, if a team were going to try to sort of inventively exploit a team going down to 10 men, it would be Frank, because I thought, in like, he looked at the situation here, of course, then eventually he took all the defenders off, but the way he got Rico Henry to attack on the left versus, I think it was Iwobi and Coleman, I think, what was left of Everton's defence, he basically just played as a fourth man, I think, up front. And then he was getting down the line like all the time in the first half. He got his goal. And I thought the whole sort of approach was very like, yeah, this is Brentford. They can experiment. They're no danger of doing anything. And at this stage, they will hurt you. And I think that they played second half, almost, I think for me, almost perfectly.
All right. Well, Everton will be at Arsenal next Sunday. But before that, they have the game with Palace. If they get the win there at Goodison, they will be safe. So there you go. Burnley, meanwhile, are the team, as we mentioned, in the bottom three. But a little bit unjustly, would you say? Did you feel bad for them losing that game at Spurs on the basis of that kind of pretty iffy penalty?
Yeah, well, it is a penalty, but it's another one of those where the punishment doesn't really seem to fit the crime, in that it's the same. That's the same punishment for a handball as it would be, apart from the red cards, if you handballed it on the line, which seems slightly farcical, but those are the rules, and I think it was a penalty by those rules. Burnley had the absolute perfect game plan. I thought they were brilliant against Tottenham. I think last week against Villa, Mike Jackson got a little bit of a scare because he's been trying to play this expansive football and they've done it well, and they just got picked off by Villa at home last weekend. And I thought he would go more resolute anyway against Tottenham, but they were very deep defensively. But what they did really well is with the third defender, they told Nathan Collins to step up out of defence and try and play passes through. And he created the best chance of the game for Burnley for Maxwell Cornet with a... this is a Burnley central defender who was about 35 yards from goal in open play and played a through ball to an attacking midfielder. So they didn't abandon the expansiveness, but they were brilliant defensively. And they shuttled Spurs out. They stopped them crossing from near the goal line, which is where Spurs' best chances came from. They made them cross from wide and deep. I thought they more than merited a point. I thought they were excellent. Spurs had chances, clearly, and Nick Pope was named man of the match. But you need that. You're playing a team that's far better than you with a brilliant strike force. And I thought Burnley were brilliant. If they play like that against Villa, they'll win the game.
Harry Kane converting the penalty after Ashley Barnes' kind of ephemeral forearm contact, possibly with the air adjacent to the passage of the ball. I mean, I've heard this idea, and I think it's a compelling one, that the penalties are wildly disproportionate in quite a few cases. I mean, to determine a game on something as random as that does seem wrong. How would you, Daniel, as someone who's clearly given this some thought, how would you resolve that that injustice?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, yes, I absolutely agree with you. Football is unique as a sport and it only has 2.5 around scores per game. And I'd say 90 to 95% of the penalties you give, those offences are not, you know, equatable to someone having a shot 12 yards from goal against a goalkeeper. I don't know is the honest answer. I mean, there's an argument for having in cases where it's not a deliberate foul, i.e. the same ones as those denied of the last goal scoring opportunity, if you go for the ball and miss it, making it an indirect free kick rather than a penalty. But then you just get a kind of messy situation where you have 20 players in the box all trying to block the ball. Maybe there isn't an answer. Maybe it's... Well, yeah, maybe sin bins, but then I still think you get teams deliberately fouling or making fouls and happy to take the sin bin. You know, we've seen arguments for old Nazzle-style penalties where you run from the halfway line for a one-on-one. Yeah. I think it's very hard to change without changing the fabric of the game, and VAR has shifted this because it has inevitably lowered the bar of proof for penalties to be awarded, and that has changed the conversation because... a goal is incredibly valuable in football, and therefore a penalty is incredibly valuable in football because you have about a 90% at least chance of scoring. And when you then have a marginal decision, which is technically right by the law, but that nobody really believes is worth what is effectively a free shot at goal, you do slightly have a problem. We haven't quite got to the stage yet where teams are playing for penalties in normal time as a strategy, but I'd be amazed if managers aren't talking about it with players. You know, go down, aiming for the arm with a cross. I can see how it would happen. It would be sillier if it didn't.
Team we haven't talked about yet from the relegation picture are Leeds, who earned themselves a vital lifeline with that 92nd minute equaliser from Pascal Struijk against Brighton. How big was that goal?
Biggest goal of the weekend. Just amazing. I mean, Leeds will not go quietly. They're scrapping and having so many of their problems self-inflicted over the last few games with Luke Ayling and Dan James, and a real sort of makeshift nature to their setup. To recover from being a goal down to one of the best teams away from home in the division as well, a team that had created chances and performed in that slick way that we know that Brighton can. For them to conjure an equaliser right at the death of that has just fueled their hope and given them something to take into next weekend. I mean, obviously, they're, as I say, Thursday night, them watching schools rolling in from Villa Park and Goodison Park is going to be agony. It's going to be excruciating, but they will have a chance on that last day. They will have a chance.
Last day sees them visiting Brentford, while Burnley host Newcastle and Everton travel to Arsenal. Arsenal, who haven't played yet, and neither have Newcastle, of course, because they face each other on this Monday evening.
Question on Brighton, Dom. Is it important for Palace to finish above Brighton this season, and which do you think is currently the better team in terms of playing football?
Brighton are the better team because they've been working with Graham Potter for three seasons now. Patrick Vieira's had, he hasn't even had 12 months. Is it important for Palace to... Well, look, I mean, it would be the first time in a long time. I think the first time actually since Palace were promoted in 2013 that Brighton will have finished above them. Palace beat them in the playoffs that year. But I think there's a sense of realism at Palace. You know, you can't transform a team overnight. And in fact, what they have achieved this season has been as well as it could have done, really. I think they'll continue to kick on, particularly if they have another good summer of recruitment, and they'll hopefully have another good summer of recruitment this year. And I mean, look, in the two games against Brighton this season, not so much at the Amex, but certainly at Selhurst Park, they've really competed for long periods against them. In previous, the last 2 years, there have been moments where Brighton have played them off the park. They haven't won, but they played them off the park. And I think that gap in style has now been trimmed, and Palace will hope that that's sort of started a trend.
Brighton currently lying 10th in the top half, 3 points clear of Palace, but Palace have a game in hand. Crikey. We'll deal with some any other business then after this.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're all driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/totally. That's Indeed.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at Indeed.com.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only, get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs, maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds, online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Listener, I mentioned that the Athletic Women's Football Podcast is out on Tuesday. So is the Totally Football Show European Edition. Bit of a must listen this time around as well, as we look ahead to the Europa League final, Eintracht Frankfurt against Rangers. But also hear about the departures in the Bundesliga, not just Erling Haaland, but Robert Lewandowski saying that he wants out of Bayern Munich as well. We'll catch up on the Italian title race, which is going right down to the wire, and loads of other stuff as well. Ooh, Sasha.
I was going to ask, are you guys going to talk about Union Berlin finishing sixth and now getting into Europa League, the club from Köpenick?
Yeah, absolutely. We certainly will, Sasha. A Totally Football League show is out right now. So if you're bored of this, that's there for you. Matt Davis, Adams and co. Recorded on Sunday night. What on earth might they be chatting about in that, do you think, Daniel?
Well, yeah. I mean, yes, on Tuesday night I will be going to the City Ground for the second leg. I should be watching a procession by rights, because Forest should have been two or three, or dare I even say it, four goals up at half time.
Right.
Eventually did get the second goal, albeit after a period of Sheffield United pressure, and then did what I assumed they would do, which is concede basically in the last minute, which tightens the tie up. There is an argument given Forest famously won 2-0 away at Yeovil in the League One playoffs, assumed they were through, and then lost 5-2 at home.
Ooh.
That late goal is probably not the worst thing for Forest, in that at least it will mean that they don't think they're through. But it is going to be a horrendously nervous night. For people that don't know and assume that Forest's only rivalry is with Derby, there are plenty of Forest fans, probably me included, who think that the Sheffield United kind of rivalry is a more fierce, almost more fierce one in terms of match days than the Derby one.
Why is that?
Why?
I don't really know. I know there's a kind of historical element to it, going back to the miners' crisis and that sort of thing, and the kind of difference between Yorkshire and Nottingham at that point. But it's just incredibly bitter and fierce. We also have history with them. They knocked us out of the playoffs in 2003 when they drew at home and Forest managed to again lose an extra time in the playoffs. So yes, it's going to be a horribly nervous night at the City Ground on Tuesday.
Will Flea out of the Red Hot Chili Peppers be there?
I don't know, and I also don't know why you've asked.
He tweeted before the first leg, Nottingham right. Forest is going down, Capitals up the blades, 3 exclamation marks. That's quite
okay. I mean, Forest are able to magic any sort of crisis out of positivity. But if we go down this season, I'll be annoyed. Put it that way.
Okay. I think he means going down in the sense of getting defeated.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of water to go under the bridge before that.
Very good.
Nice. Anyway, more on that in the Totally Football League show, which is out, as I say, right now.
I was going to ask, Daniel, what's your rivalry like with Luton?
It's a kind of historic one because of cup finals. Because of 1959 FA Cup final, we beat them, and 1988 League Cup final, we beat them. Luton worry me because they have absolutely, you know, they have a free shot at the playoffs, basically. I think Huddersfield would beat them. I think if we get through, then it'll be Forest Huddersfield at Wembley, not Luton. But that doesn't do a disservice to how brilliantly Nathan Jones has done this season.
Now, meanwhile, on this podcast, if you're still with us, got a couple of games that took place this weekend. And Dom points out, we never mentioned Mark Noble. They only gave him an hour for his farewell and we still forgot about it. Dom, were you moved?
If I was a West Ham fan, I definitely would be. I think it's what an achievement as a one club player. Hopefully he gets his 550th game on the final weekend. It's a hell of an achievement, and the weird thing about Mark Noble is, I think when he started out, I don't think anyone envisaged that he would be a one club stalwart, that he would have this career and maybe endear himself in the way that he has over 18 years in the West Ham first team. But he's become Mr. West Ham. I think it's great because I suspect that we won't see this happen very often anymore. They're probably going to become rarer and rarer. They're not particularly common as it is to have somebody play this number of games for one club and then retire off into the sunset. But it was great. I mean, to see his kids out on the pitch with him and see him inviting Prince Albert of Monaco into the stands. I mean, that's pretty weird and quite interesting.
Was Prince Albert there at his invitation?
Yeah, he was. So,
one nobleman to another, I suppose.
Oh.
Yeah, the story was apparently that Prince Albert fell in love with Dimitri Payet as a West Ham player.
Huh.
And because of that, at some point became friendly. And I think they are good friends now with Mark Noble, and got in touch with Noble to request that he could be at his last game. So, yeah, it was bizarre seeing it on the TV, but it's nice, isn't it? And yeah, Noble is, by all accounts, one of the good guys. You know, he looks after young players in the academy. He offers advice. Jesse Lingard, even, you know, he tweeted on Sunday to say, even in the short time I was there, he took me under my wing. He taught me through everything. He made me feel comfortable. Do not underestimate, even when they're not playing that much, do not underestimate the difference that players like that make in a dressing room. And if I'm David Moyes, then, you know, I don't know what Noble's got lined up, but if he's not trying to keep him on the staff next season, he'd be a fool, because he will make a huge difference in that dressing room.
Well, yeah, hopefully we'll get another run out in West Ham's season finale next weekend. Meantime, on the subject of goodbyes, Roy Hodgson's last home game in charge of the Hornets came on Sunday, in which the worst home team in the Premier League took on Leicester, shipped 5 goals. But of course, even here, Leicester conceded from a set piece. Yay!
Weird situation where you get the man who's taking over in a few weeks' time paraded prior to kickoff on the pitch. Very, very odd. Very, very strange. Right. But it's a strange situation, genuinely, isn't it? At Watford.
Yeah, you do get the sense that Hodgson isn't that bothered if it's a bit strange, is it?
Should Hodgson get more stick for this? Should he get more stick for the way they Watford absolutely disastrously bombed? Because I get the feeling that everyone's looking, oh, well, Hodgson, you know, one last job, came out of retirement. Oh, well, you know, he's kind of drifting off somewhere. They've been terrible. It's just been absolutely abysmal run of form. This game, every single Leicester goal was a piece of absolutely atrocious defending in different ways. You know, defenders falling over, keeper coming to the edge, missing it, unmarked players get mugged in midfield. And, there's no fight about the whole thing at all. And I don't know what Hodgson is saying to them behind the scenes, but it's like they've just completely stopped.
I'm not sure it's a compliment to Watford, Sash, but I think what saves him from getting that stick is that Watford were also terrible under the two managers before him season.
I completely get that point, but over a long period of time, there's been absolutely zero improvement. And you know what? Maybe the reason that Watford has fallen apart is because I think it coincides with Emma Saunders leaving to go to Sky properly. Because I think since she left, I'm pretty sure their only win was probably that game against United, and they lost the rest of the home games. Because I was thinking this, because she was interviewing players after the Brentford-Everton game, and I was thinking, it's sort of putting the timelines together. It's probably, since Emma left, I don't think they won a home game, or maybe one.
Do we know much about Rob Edwards coming in from Forest Green Rovers?
Yeah, he's done a brilliant job at Forest Green. They took a bit of a punt on him because he'd not had a first team job before that. He was doing just academy coaching and first team coaching. Dale Vince is at pains to say he took a chance on him, because that's all ended in a very messy situation with Vince. Not unreasonably saying that if you were going to go and leave to another club after telling me you wanted to stay next season, we're looking forward to trying to get us up into the Championship, it might have been nice for you to, at that point, say that you were considering talking to Watford, and then proceeded to talk to Watford before being appointed. Look, the loyalty argument is always blurry because it's a two-way street and clubs are very quick to get rid of managers. But it's a shame it's ended like that at Forest Green, because he did a fantastic job last season. And it's a change for Watford. It's a very different approach. I hope it means that it's a change in terms of the long-termism and the patience of it as well. But it's a a bold step to appoint a manager that has only ever managed in League Two at a club who basically will be demanding automatic promotion next season.
Hmm. Also, goodbye, or at least the final home game for Ben Foster. Is he retiring at the end of the season?
No, he's not. He's going to look for another club.
Right.
He's leaving Watford. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see where he goes. I think there will be some interest from teams in England, but possibly he might fancy something abroad.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, is he a candidate for the Champions League club third choice goalkeeper role, or do you think he wants to be playing?
I think he wants to be playing, to be honest. I think I saw Watford the other week, and he was their outstanding player on the pitch. And I know he's been he like everybody at Watford has come in for a certain amount of stick, and he's made his mistakes. But he's also been excellent in periods in matches, and has kept them, you know, as afloat as they can be. They're not great, and that would be my defence for Roy Hodgson as well. I mean, he came in after the January transfer window. If you look at his previous jobs, he's always had sort of rock solid professionals that he could call upon. I mean, at Watford, it was Ben Foster, Craig Cathcart, Tom Cleverley, I suppose, in midfield.
Sissoko,
and he has actually done okay for them. But I think if you went to any of Sissoko's previous clubs and said, "We're going to make you, this is the man we want to build our survival hopes on," I don't think many people would say, "Oh, great, this is going well." Then, I mean, I think that was an impossible job. I think of all the mistakes made, Roy Hodgson made the mistake by taking that job on. He should have just stayed well away.
Mm. Well, Ben Foster conceding 5 this Sunday. 2 of them were from Jamie Vardy, who's now got 4-2 against 2 relegated sides, because he also put 2 past Norwich previously. And Norwich this weekend had a 1-1 draw with Wolves. Crikey. Point there for the Canaries means they've now bettered their record low points tally of a couple of seasons ago. And they actually scored a goal as well, which is the first time in, well, not done much that late. That leaves one game which we haven't mentioned, but Dom, take it away with your thoughts on Aston Villa 1, Crystal Palace 1.
Well, I don't have any thoughts in terms of in Palace, but I would say that Palace creating 16 chances at Aston Villa would be good news for Burnley, because I don't think Villa's defence is as rock-tight as it should be, watertight as it should be, rather. And that should also offer Manchester City some considerable encouragement as well.
Hmm.
The Philip Coutinho flipping the cliche on its head by being not like a new signing is good. Obviously, Villa announced in the week they were signing on a permanent deal. This is his 9th league game in a row without a goal or assist. Hmm. And Emi Buendia in that time, who Gerrard was asked why Buendia wasn't in the team, and he said, well, he needs to contribute more goals and assists if he wants to be in this team. He then started Buendia, who both scored and assisted, and then immediately dropped Buendia back to the bench for Coutinho. I get why you want to use Philip Coutinho, but I cannot get my head around relegating your club record signing to the fringes of the first team squad to accommodate a player who I think he's past his best. He has flashes of brilliance. And I was at Villa Park with Sasha on last Tuesday, and Coutinho did this brilliant flick over a defender's head and then ran round and played a pass and then lost the ball in midfield. And that's kind of how it's been at Villa so far. There's been these flashes of excellence, but it's just not quite happening. And the money makes sense. €20 million is, or £20 million is not a lot of money. And he's taken a massive pay cut to join Villa because he says he wants to start every week. But I'd start Buendia over him at the moment.
Reports have Luis Suarez prospectively joining this kind of Anfield reunion at Villa Park next season. That'd be interesting. Anyway, lots of crazy transfer talk on the way because summer's almost here, listener. And so is the end of this Totally Football show. Many thanks for being with us, Dom and Sasha and Daniel, producer Charlie, and you, listener. Loads of other great podcast content out there, as we mentioned, and yes, on Thursday we'll be back again with our thoughts on some of the midweek games, certainly Newcastle, Arsenal and Saints Liverpool, and a big look forward to the final day of the season. Do join us for that. But now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following The Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.